believe it was as a teenager that I first really kind of encountered the term counterculture. And as I recall, it was applied to those back in those dark ages who were identified as hippies. And probably some of you have heard of that. Maybe some of you that are younger have even seen pictures of those. But these were folks that lived in a way that just almost totally and completely rejected the cultural norms of society and lived in a way that was completely counter. And so the term counterculture, their culture, was that which was counter to the norm as it was perceived. Since then, I've heard the term used numerous times in application to different groups of people who were living in a way that was different from, that was indeed a rejection of the norms of society. And one way in which I have seen that or heard that term employed is in reference to those who are Christians, that Christians are a counterculture people. And I think in many ways that's probably a pretty accurate description. It seems to me that that's precisely what the Scriptures call upon God's people to be a people who are different, to be a people who are not being conformed to this world, but a people who are transformed by the renewing of their minds, Paul would say in Romans chapter 12. And a people who then have gone through, and he uses indeed the Greek word for metamorphosis, a people who have gone through an alteration of themselves, by which they come to live in a way that is truly counter to the culture in which they lived. But this is not something that is applicable to the people of the New Testament. It was true of the people of the Old Testament as well. The psalmist says in Psalms 97 and verse 10, "Hate evil, you who love the Lord." If you're going to love the Lord, it is going to require a willingness to live in this counterculture kind of environment. The simple fact is that we cannot love things that are good without hating things that are evil. We come back to the New Testament in the book of Romans again in the 12th chapter, down in the 9th verse. There the Apostle Paul said essentially the same thing that the psalmist had said when he says, "Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good." The word cling there suggests very much the same idea that we get in the gospel accounts where Jesus is talking about marriage and the design that God had for marriage when he spoke about a husband cleaving to his wife, clinging to her, being attached, as it were. Some commentators say it conveys the idea of being glued to one another. And so Paul uses very much the same kind of line of thinking when he urges his brethren here to cling to what is good. Well, that just in and of itself might be, you know, easily accepted by people if you just say, well, cling to what is good. But it is a statement that is made in that context of abhor what is evil. Totally, completely reject what is evil. So you have that counterculture kind of aspect to what Paul is saying. When we talk about this, we're talking about basically a rejection of the world. And you've heard this observed before, that when the Scriptures speak about us rejecting the world, it, or hating the world in this context. It's not talking about hating the globe upon which we live. This globe is not evil. In the creation accounts, we see where as God created this world at every stage, he looked at it and he says it's good. So what God terms as being something that's good is certainly not something that we are expected to hate. Nor is this word world in this biblical context, nor does it mean the world of people. It's not talking about hating people. God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son. Talking about humanity, God's love for humanity. And we, too, are urged to love mankind. But what this is urging upon us is being willing to reject that which so many others that we encounter in our lives have accepted. To reject what so many others have embraced. And to find abhorrent what so many others find appealing. And that will inevitably put us at odds with most people that we will encounter in our life. And many times it will be putting us at odds with people that we know very well, people to whom we are very close, people that we love many times in family kinds of relationships. It will put us in conflict with the way in which they live, because we are defined the way in which they live to be something that is abhorrent. So I want to talk to you for a few minutes this evening about this system that of life, this world system that the Bible urges us not to fall in love with like so many others have. I want to suggest to you, first of all, that when the Bible speaks about this, it speaks about a system that has a character that we can identify. A very familiar passage to you along these lines would be 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15. Do not love the world. There again, he's not talking about the globe. He's not talking about humanity. But he's talking about this world system. He says, don't fall in love with that. Don't embrace it like so many others have. And he identifies the character of this world system. He says, do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God abides forever. Just very quickly, in looking at this familiar text, I want to suggest to you three things that are declared in this text. The world has a prince. This system that John says we ought to reject has a ruler. 1 John chapter 5 and in verse 19, he says that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. Not the globe. Not humanity, but this system to which much of humanity is devoted. This system, which admittedly is spread across the wide, far and wide, across this physical globe. But this world is the system that lies totally in the power of the evil one. The evil one is the prince that John in his gospel refers to in chapter 12 and verse 31. in chapter 14 and verse 30, in chapter 16 and in verse 11. John writes about this character of the world as it is ruled over by the supreme power. Satan is the mastermind behind this system that we are warned against embracing. Paul writes about it in Ephesians chapter 6 and in verse 12 when he reminds his brethren that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. We're involved in a conflict, Paul is describing. It is not a conflict of political proportions. It is not a conflict against world leaders. It's not a conflict against political figures that we might not like. He says it is against world powers. It's against spiritual forces of wickedness. It's a struggle with this system that is defined in scriptures as being worldliness. It has this character that can be identified by who rules over it. Its character can also be identified by the philosophy that it embraces. Did you know that worldliness has a philosophy? Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 19, Paul says that the wisdom of the world is foolishness before God. The way that this system thinks, the way that it operates, is in God's eyes foolishness. In the world's eyes, it's wisdom. It's the smart way to live. It's the intelligent way to pursue your life. But God says, no, it's a foolish way to live. And it's a disastrous way to pursue your life. It not only has a prince, it not only has a philosophy, but it also has a purpose. Interesting verse over in John chapter 7 and verse 7. During the course of Jesus' earthly ministry, John chapter 7 and verse 7, we read, as you look in the context, we see that it's a verse in which Jesus is carrying on a conversation with his brothers. His brothers want him to go up to Jerusalem at the time of the Passover to show himself publicly. They're giving him the best PR advice that they can give him. Problem is, it's a worldly kind of advice. They say, well, nobody holds themselves back who wants to be heard and who wants to be believed. You've got to get out there and you've got to promote yourself is what they're trying to convince their older brother, Jesus. But verse 5 says that the reason that they were doing this was because not even his brothers were believing in him. Now, we'll go back to my point a few moments ago of how living in this way, identifying evil, abhorring evil, will put us at cross purposes with so many people that we encounter in this life, sometimes our closest kin. You know, you may think you've encountered problems with family members and because of your religious views, they reject this and maybe they mistreat you and they do things and say things that they ought not to say. And you may think nobody has ever had to deal with this. I'm the only person, and I know you wouldn't say that, but sometimes that's the way we go about dealing with those situations. As though I'm the only person that's had... Even Jesus had to deal with this. His own brothers did not believe him. Now listen to what he says about it in verse 7. He says, the world cannot hate you. Isn't that interesting? The world can't hate you. You know why? Because they're part of it. They don't believe in him. They're thinking in the way the world thinks. They're committed to the ways of the world. The world can't hate you, Jesus says, because you're part of it. But it hates me. You want to know what the difference is? Look at the end of verse 7. Because I testify of it that its deeds are evil. You know what Jesus did when he encountered the prince of this world, when he encountered the philosophy of this world, when he confronted the purposes of this world? He said, that's evil. That's wrong. That can't be sanctioned. And those who are associated with that kind of practice that he would condemn didn't like it. That's why they hated him, but they couldn't hate his brothers. Now, as you read on through the Bible, you'll find indications that things changed for his brothers. I'll tell you the good news here is that if you are caught up in the ways of the world, you can get out of them. And the indications are that at least some of Jesus' kinfolks did get out of it. But at this point in time, Jesus was at cross purposes with even some in his own family, living a counterculture life for sure, because he would not follow the world's prince, because he would not accept the world's philosophy, and he would not join in with the world's purposes. Now, as you look back in John's letter, in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, when he identifies there the corruptions of the world. The world has a character that we can identify. We can define its character. It also is corrupting. The corruption of the world is laid out for us there by John the Apostle when he talked about the ways of the world. This is the world. This is the world system. It is the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life. It is the passions, the possessions, and the positions that people caught up in this world system seek for. We won't take the time to talk about it to any great extent this evening, but you know, there's an interesting thing about what this corrupting character that the world has, as John defines it. Maybe I'm amiss on this, but it looks to me like the three things he defines neatly fit into three basic categories of life. Meaning that at every stage in life, we have things that we will have to confront that are of this world system. The lust of the eyes, those passions in our youth that are stronger perhaps during that point of our life than in later times of our life. The lust of the flesh, with the passions that are stirred in that early point. The lust of the eyes, the desire to possess things. You know, you get along into that midpoint in life. You get past those young years, and you get to that midpoint in life, and you begin to kind of evaluate and look at yourself and kind of judge where you are in relation to others. And the way we so often judge it is, what kind of car am I driving? How big is my house? What neighborhood is my house in? All of a sudden, possessions can really come to occupy our loyalties, maybe more so than they did when we were younger. We had other things on our minds when we were younger. And then when we get to be older, the pride of life, the position, the recognition, the esteem. You get an older fella, sometimes it happens within, you know, within congregations, and he just got to have his way. He's just got to be the guy who calls the shots. I don't know what age Diotrephes was. I just kind of imagine him as being, he's that character that John speaks of in his subsequent letters. He was the guy who just, he had to run the show. I just imagine him as being older. Now, obviously, these things can overlap, and you can have a young guy who just thinks he's got to have his way and he's got to call all the shots. I understand that. I'm not saying these are just set in concrete. But generally speaking, it looks to me like that's kind of the way we progress through life and the challenges that we face. And the point that we need to understand is this: you and I are never going to get to a point where we don't have to face the choice of living in a counterculture sort of way. You and I will never get to a point where we don't have to make the decision that I'm going to reject the things that so many of my contemporaries accept. I'm going to live differently. And I'm going to reject the corruption of this world, just like I'm going to reject the character of this world. And I'm going to do it very simply because this world, this system that we're talking about, has a condemnation. Look, if you would, back to 1 John chapter 2. As we've read verses 15 and 16, now look at verse 17 where John says this: the world is passing away and its lusts, but the one who does the will of God abides forever. You want to live your life like so many others do, and you want to be driven by the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life as you progress through the stages of life. Understand this. At the end of it all, this world, not the globe, not humanity, but this system of living is going to pass away. And all of its lusts, and all of the passions, all of the possessions, all of the positions that you have attained while pursuing your life in this worldly fashion, they're not going to last. I'll tell you what lasts. John says, what lasts is those who do the will of the Father. And there's one thing that we've got to understand about doing the will of the Father. If you don't understand this, you're going to be sorely disappointed if you ever decide, I'm going to become a Christian, I'm going to follow Jesus. You're going to be sorely disappointed if you don't understand this. Those who do the will of the Father are never going to fit in with the world system. You're always going to be living counterculturally with the world if you're doing the will of the Father. But you have this assurance that those who will do the will of the Father will abide forever. And so, if you're not a Christian, you just need to make a choice. You know, that's what this life is really about. What it comes down to is we just make a lot of choices. And this is the most important one. You just need to choose whether or not you're going to live in keeping with the ways that so many others live, that is temporary, that is passing away, or whether you're going to live in a way that acknowledges the wisdom of God, whether you're going to set your life to doing the will of God with the assurance that you'll abide forever. That's your choice. It's just, where are you going to live? If you want to live within the kingdom of God, then what you need to do, if you haven't done so already, is to obey the gospel. Jesus came teaching men and women that they must believe that He is, and that believing that He is, they must repent of their sins, confess Him to be the Son of God, and be baptized, washing their sins away, free of the guilt of past sins, then responsible to live this life in a way that keeps you in the will of God and not in the world. Won't you do that tonight while we stand and sing together?